And then someone went,
testing, 1, 2.
I can really taste the bacteria.
What's up, John? What's up, John Burton?
1, 2, 3, 4. Why you can't have a best?
Okay, wait. Let me rewind. John, you're right.
Right. I'm just going to play us in a little bit.
When are you going to tell me we're starting?
We started.
Okay. Awesome.
I like to do it, and I also appreciate your observation that being in person has a different impact than if you'd work virtually.
Hold on 1 second. There we go. Now I can hear myself. By the way, Michael Harris.
Indeed.
Director of
Home-Based Crisis Intervention Services at Aster Services for Children and Families.
Perfect. It is always better to come in person. And I don't know. I just don't know how to do it any other way. I've done like a couple of them. Like 2 years ago, I did a Ukrainian Christmas special where I had a woman, her name is Leslie Verba, and she kind of like the Ukraine's Taylor Swift, and she escaped and came over here, and I was going to have her in the studio, and we were going to do a Christmas special for Ukraine, but her train got all messed up and she couldn't make it to the studio. And so we did it on the phone, and it was horrible. And I'm like, that's the last one I'm ever doing like that. Aster Services. By the way, full disclosure, I grew up in Rhinebeck and went there myself.
Awesome.
Yeah.
What was your experience with Aster?
It was amazing. I was getting counseling. I was in foster home and then got adopted, and the home was berserk. And so I had a counselor, and I was able to go twice a week. It cost me nothing, and I got through high school. So thank you, first off.
You're welcome. And that's one of the things that I love about Aster and community mental health in general is that equity and access, that everybody can get connected.
Yeah.
Right? Irrespective of cost. I speak with some families that are in private insurance or out-of-pocket pay for therapy for their kids, and they're spending $800, $1,000 a month.
Easy.
More than their car payments.
Easy.
Right?
Yeah.
And with an organization like Aster, all insurances, Medicaid, real access.
But now, when I went, we did it by candlelight. No, but when I went, they didn't even ask. They were just like, okay, kid, come on in.
Yeah.
And, but you all have grown a lot since 1920 when I...
I doubt it's quite that long.
It was. I'll tell you when. It was 78, 79, somewhere in there, yeah.
Yeah, as it stands now. So Aster in Dutchess County is very well associated with Rhinebeck and the main headquarters there. And over time, as Aster's operated for more than 70 years, more than 700 staff now between like Hudson all the way down to the Bronx.
Wow.
We serve over 9,000 kids and families a year. With lots of programs like mental health outpatient clinic, like you were treated through.
Yep.
And then a range of other community-based services, partial hospitalization programs, therapeutic foster care, long, long list.
So thank you for your work. And we'll cover all of Aster, but I'm super interested in your – I dug around a little bit to try to not sound like an idiot on the air. And the increase – like everybody knows that there's an increase in mental health issues with children. Everybody knows that. That's not – the degree of it, the CDC reports that one in every five children has a mental health issue – and that one in every eight of children who are admitted to a hospital for anything, sprain my ankle, mm-hmm. have a mental health issue. And I'm a parent. Are you a parent?
I am.
Okay. How many kids?
Two.
Two. How old?
They are teenagers.
Oh, yeah. My daughter's going to be 17 in November. She's taking her driver's test in 10 days. And I have a calendar on my computer, and it's just like a giant red X through that day because I'm not. Do any of your kids drive?
They are working on it now.
Oh, man. And how much hair have you lost?
What I would say is I'm using my professional skills.
You have an advantage, right? Right, right. That's true. You do. You have an advantage. Oh, man. That's an interesting question. Do you use your professional skills parenting?
All the time. And I'll respect my kids' privacy and not get into their story, but I will say that they also have good phone poking the bear.
Okay.
And challenging whether I'm effectively using my skills.
Nice. What skills do you have that I don't, that I could use with my children that would benefit?
Well, I'll flip around and say it would be a presumption to assume that I don't, right? Based on your lived experience, what your personal strengths are, you might rock it more than me already. And at the same time, there are ways that we train to be able to understand why behaviors occur, what the functions of behaviors are, what that might indicate about how to respond. And we are trained to be able to do that, right? And what I've noticed is some of the most powerful assets that we have are simply being present, mm-hmm. being mindful, and being compassionate.
Yeah. I had a when my wife was going to have my daughter, I was nervous. And one of my friends is an electrician, and I was petrified of having a kid. I waited till I was 43 years old to have a child because I just wasn't ready. I'm glad I waited, but and I was nervous about it. And so I asked him, like, you know, because he had like four kids, and I'm like, what's the trick? He goes, they don't want cars, they don't want clothes, they don't want a big house, they want you. If you are there and present and mindful, that's the best thing that you could do.
Yeah. And you have a sense, too, as I hear you talk about it, how stressful that is as a parent.
Oh.
In this particular situation that we're inhabiting economically, socially, all of the above. And for us to be able to show up as our best selves. Not easy.
No, right.
And those situations where if a parent just happened to wind up in a situation where through the cosmic lottery, they were assigned a kiddo that was a little more difficult in terms of their temperament, their needs, the level of stress that puts on the parent, as they try to hold the space for the child to be able to be their best self, challenge.
Real challenge, yeah.
And if the child's behaviors escalate, and it winds up pulling the parent into that tension, into that fight, into that drama, into that emotion overflow, mm-hmm. you can see how those two patterns would reinforce themselves. And breaking that down and helping each learn to manage themselves and manage their relationship is a big part of the process.
And counterintuitive.
Yep.
Because when, as a parent, and we should say, so what you do, too much to talk about, sorry. What you do is your department is intervention so that children can stay in their homes instead of hospitals.
Yeah, so let me take a step back. So
yeah.
Home-based crisis intervention, and the acronym is HBCI,
right.
Is a program that's funded by the New York State Office of Mental Health that's aimed to serve youth age 5 to 20
okay.
who are facing a mental health crisis that's so severe that they're at acute risk of inpatient hospitalization. Mm. And that assessment of acuity also can relate to fear by other providers about whether they can keep a family or a child safe and may not necessitate that they actually have to be in a hospital. What they need is a higher level of treatment than they currently have. And so we fill that gap to be able to have the treatment occur in the home rather than having to go to the hospital for it.
The advantages of treatment occurring in the home, aside from cost, are what?
So think practically. I'll give you some scenarios that we commonly work with that would put a youth at risk for hospitalization. Suicidal ideation or behavior. Self-harming behaviors. Intense physical aggression or impulse control challenges. Really intense depression or anxiety that has them shutting down, having difficulty functioning with their everyday responsibilities. Now, in some sense, a hospital can make sense if community can't support safety. But the fundamental paradox for me is this. The way hospitalization tends to work now, a young person could be in the hospital for a couple weeks, and then they're discharged back to where the problem's happening. So you got a time out, but you never worked on the interdependent causes and conditions that all align to have this crisis happen for you to wind up there. So if we can intervene at the point where that's actually happening, then you may not need to go.
And you can actually participate in solving a problem instead of, like you said, a timeout. Do you, one of the challenges I would imagine with child therapy is as an adult, I have so much more agency over my day than as a child. So I would.
Isn't that true?
Yes, is it or is it?
It
oh,
is.
Yeah, yeah.
It
is. So for me, so for therapy for John, who should go back, for therapy for John, that, you know, you can teach me a very different skill set than you can to 10-year-old John, who, you know, maybe 10-year-old John is right. Maybe this is a dysfunctional house. Maybe you are being bullied. Maybe you know, or maybe you are suffering from depression. But there's only so much you can do about it. So it's coping mechanism instead of actual treatment. That's a question mark.
Yeah. And an interesting observation that goes with that too, right, is what about a scenario where a kid's really struggling because of all those environmental factors? And the message they're getting is, I'm coming to provide therapy because it's your fault you're not handling this well.
Yeah. Yeah.
As opposed to, you're in a situation that nobody would handle well. And how do we work together to help you navigate that? Or best case scenario, if you have some open-minded folks who happen to be parenting you, can we help them improve their skills so the environment can improve?
Does that must break your heart to be sitting in that room and having not open-minded parents and thinking to yourself, if I could just crack you guys 10%, I could move you 90%.
What I would say is the vast majority of parents, even at that level of acuity, are all in for their kids. They
that's
want to
beautiful.
Learn.
Okay, good.
They want to change. And something that's beautiful about our program, the way it's funded by the Office of Mental Health, is there's no cost to families.
Mm-hmm.
In the current economic situation, we've arrived in the home. We've explained that to families. They burst into tears.
I bet.
Right? Like, I don't have a copay.
Right.
I'm not going to have to worry about whether keeping my kid out of the hospital is a trade-off for whether I pay for my car or my apartment.
Right, right. That's amazing. So your particular program, it isn't privately funded, so we can or cannot donate to it.
So Astra can be funded
okay.
and privately donated to, and that supports the entire agency, our department, and the team. Our funding comes from New York State.
Okay, great. Do you to donate to Astra, what do we do?
If you go to astraservices.org, which mm-hmm. is the Astra website,
okay.
there's an opportunity to do that through there.
Fantastic. I'll bring that
and
up a couple
also,
more times.
And there's also, if one follows Astra social media, different events that are happening from time to time, fundraisers, way to contribute, way to volunteer. So back to your question, too, about parents and that particular situation. I don't know if this is something that you experience as a parent yourself. Intergenerational trauma, and when you become a parent, often some of that unresolved pain of your own childhood winds up in your face. What also can happen quite a bit is the messages that we received about complying, sucking it up, the list is like infinite about how you're supposed to behave. Before we know it, our kid does something, and that's automatically coming out of our mouth. And we feel it viscerally through our entire body as like an automatic response.
Mm-hmm.
And to notice that and to make a choice and do something different,
mm-hmm.
that's a project.
It's a giant project. It's part of why I waited so long, because I had several cycles that I had to be very confident I was going to be able to break before I had a kid. And I watch it every day. I think I have a chronic condition anyway, but I watch my condition every day, and I also watch every day breaking the cycle. And my daughter graduates in May, and if I make it to May, that will probably be like, that's almost the biggest victory a human being can have, is breaking the cycle of what happened to you and not making it a legacy for somebody else.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's it's a ton of work, but it's also like the best gift you can give yourself.
It is.
Yeah. It and
and I don't know if you've noticed too, as a parent, as you open to that process and you draw on those deeper resources if you cultivate in your life, that maybe some of the love that you didn't get as a kid, you notice it actually starts flowing through you.
Yep.
As you're working with that child you love in your life, and all of a sudden it's filling your bucket as it's filling theirs, and isn't that a beautiful thing?
I just 2 days ago it was National Daughter's Day, and I my Facebook page is where I promote the show, and I do a lot of social media, and I'm very open about I'm part of the premise of the show is to just be like completely transparent. So I'm really transparent. So I took my daughter out to lunch and took a picture and I posted. And one of the things that I told her was that we raised each other and that we held hands making each other a better person. And I never would have, my vision of fatherhood was not that. But in, you're right, in deciding, okay, I'm never going to hit my kid no matter what. I'm never going to bring home problems that they have no control over to them. And I'm going to, my first response to anything is going to be to just listen and not react. And just doing those three things, like she made me, I grew up a lot.
you accepted the challenge and you drew a line.
Yeah.
That like that family tree pattern stops here.
Right. Now I'm very lucky in that my daughter, although this is crazy, growing up, my daughter was surrounded and she goes to a pretty affluent school system in Westchester, but growing up there, so many kids were medicated mm-hmm. that she thought medication was the norm, and I managed to work around it. But I'm very lucky that we don't have to work out. You know, we're not dealing with anything psychiatric necessarily, because that's a whole different challenge, I would imagine. Do parents push drugs or try not to do drugs?
It varies. So in a situation like Westchester, there's a different set of pressures of the pressures around high achievement,
right,
and the pressures around not keeping up and not making it to the next step of the elite.
Yep, exactly right.
And so in that scenario, you could see different funnels that lead youth into treatment
yep.
as a way to improve their game, so to speak.
Precisely.
Right? Which is not, and you were able to help your daughter see the difference.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes firmly, but yeah.
Right? And, right. And that's like a broad brush, right? And rather than Westchester in general, just meaning like in more affluent families that can happen.
Right.
Right? There's just a lot of pressure. We work across, you have experience with this, no doubt yourself, that like, mental health doesn't know socioeconomic boundaries.
No.
As a home-based program, we could be in what some folks would call the trailer park as opposed to somebody's lovely small home. We could be in like Section 8 public housing. We could be in a mansion. We could be in a middle-class house. All of those. And seeing the same kind of symptoms that occur.
Mm-hmm.
And appreciating in those areas where folks are living with those socioeconomic vulnerabilities, there's that much more pressure and
right,
stress.
Right. It's a template question ChatGPT would ask you, but I'll ask you.
Mm-hmm.
Social media, advice on how to handle that for children?
So it's interesting. I'll take a step back and approach it through a frame of reference. So we're primarily working with behavioral therapeutic methods mm-hmm. on our team and our program. And that challenges us to maintain a stance of psychological flexibility and openness and not polarize into things are just this way.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
So there's like all kinds of doomsday.
Which is probably a great way to view reality, period,
right.
whether you're in
right.
treatment or not.
So there's all kinds of doomsday discussions about social media. We know that there are real risks of social media. And it's a way that kids connect and socialize now. So there's a bit of this paradox here that how can they use the tools instead of the tools using them? And I'll add a related point, which is for some kids, the risk is much higher, particularly kids with ADHD and mood disorders and stress, because it creates these closed feedback loops around sometimes negative content that affects their mood and draws them down, or for kids that are more attentionally challenged, that just dopamine search function of getting conditioned. So for me, it's not useful to take a broad brush and say bad for everybody, but we do know for some kids, like high utilization of it can be like a kind of toxin that makes their symptoms work. So it's challenging for parents to be able to help kids monitor that and pace themselves, where given the pressure parents are under, there's a real temptation for that to be the babysitter.
So much of what you do is art as opposed to science, because it's so case by case that it's really an art form to figure out.
It is.
Makes it really hard for you to give general advice.
Well, I'll out myself too as like a counseling and psychology geek. Like, I love looking at the research and the data. Mm. And you know, speaking of social media, once you do that, that's what floods your news feed.
Yeah. Yes.
And at the same time, like putting that aside and showing up in the present moment and being able to notice what's actually happening and have some hypotheses you can test scientifically and work on behavior change is an art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know about the Lifted Project?
Go ahead and fill me in.
Okay. So Lifted Project we did last year, and I'm going to pitch you guys to participate. Lifted Project, we did it last year. It's kind of like a Hudson Valley, We Are the World. Because of the show, I know like a lot of musicians, and the Hudson Valley is very strange because per capita talented musician rate here is insane. And so I took 38 musicians who'd been on the show. We sold out the Hudson Valley Airport, which was cool, and we performed a song I wrote for four nonprofit partners. One of them this year is going to be James's Warriors. And we didn't raise money for
them. Oh, yeah. No, you meant James's Warriors.
Yeah. I actually sit on the board of James's Warriors. I'm actually on a board. Something's wrong. but they're participating this year.
Your self-expectations have been shattered.
They really have.
I was never going to be a board dude.
And now I'm on a website. Something's really wrong. But teenage suicidal ideations, something that I feel there should almost be a course for every parent to take about recognizing when your kid is headed down that path. Can you give us the course now? Yeah. we're not time constrained, so just go ahead if it's 3 hours.
Yeah. So that's a challenge that we see quite frequently. Of what brings kids into treatment, we can see it with adolescents. We see it with kids in the elementary age now too.
Yeah.
8, 7, 6.
Wow.
Right? I'll take a step back and say too, when you train clinically to become a therapist, you wind up in different placements, right? When you're doing your rotations, you're earning your hours, you're doing your training. I wound up in this program, and unbeknownst to me, it turned out I was really effective at working with suicidal youth. When I was in graduate school, it never occurred to me, I'm going to work with suicidal youth.
Right.
When it turned out I was really good at it, which shocked me, then I had a bit of a moral quandary. If you're effective at helping those who are at the most risk of being hurt, should you do something else? And my answer was no.
That's the right answer.
So I wound up spending a lot of time with youth in that situation. And what I observe is the following. Suicidal ideation, and there's a way to assess that we use. Something that's very common in the field. It's called the Columbia Scale. And you'll look at there's a range of severity around the kind of ideation, starting with what could be called a death wish, meaning like, I don't know if I want to be alive anymore. I've had it. Like, maybe I just shouldn't wake up in the morning. Versus just start thinking about what that might involve versus coming up to the next step of actually thinking about methods and a plan and then taking it even further and start taking steps of letting people know I might check out, right?
Right.
And you can see that continuum there.
Yep.
Then you can also look at the frequency and the intensity of the ideation itself. how often does it occur? When it occurs, how long does it last? How well are they able to cope and manage those thoughts and feelings? Or does it completely flood them and they feel helpless? Mm. And what is the function of it? Is it a way to exert some control over their environment? Or are they feeling such a level of emotional pain that they feel they can't handle it anymore here on Earth?
Mm-hmm. Right. And by the way, that doesn't change as you go into adulthood. I was suicidal, and that's the track exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the only element maybe that I would add is there is a phase where to rationalize, to have suicide make sense, you start thinking that you're doing the people around you a favor as well.
Yep.
That everybody would be better off without me.
The mind's tricky that way, isn't it?
So it is it's such a sinister disease, because when you're physically sick and you know you're physically sick, you don't rationalize it and say, okay, I need to live with this. You go get treated for it. But especially suicidal ideation, part of it is the rationalization of it. Mm-hmm. That, wait a second, no, this isn't a sickness. This is love. I'm actually giving you love by taking me out of the equation, which is, that's compelling.
It is. And it's interesting, right? So as you consider your own lived experience with this, maybe what I'll say here makes sense based on what you've observed. So within suicidal ideation, and you could also argue within substance use, is one constructive impulse. And that constructive impulse is the part of us that doesn't want to suffer anymore.
Yes.
So we're trying to find a solution to that suffering.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is, in that moment of pain, our brain's not giving us reasonable options.
Correct.
It's suggesting permanent solutions to temporary problems.
Right.
You can't undo it.
Right.
And although the brain will try to tell you it's automatically better when you're gone, we don't know that.
Right.
Psychological researchers can try to send out a lot of surveys to those that died that way. And guess what? None of them come back.
Or they're incomplete.
Right. So being able to understand how the mind works, to begin to challenge some of those thoughts that are arising within that frame of appreciating, well, thank you, the part of me that doesn't want to suffer. Now let's make more effective choices.
Right.
About how we can do that,
and when you're in that stew, the permanent solution to temporary problems. When you're in that stew, part of the path out is understanding the word temporary. Because when you're in the stew, those aren't temporary problems.
It feels infinite.
Yep.
Right.
It
doesn't feel like it's going to stop.
Right.
And so part of the challenge is what I notice with suicidal ideation through direct experience, and the research bears this out, is you can almost imagine a curve. And at the top of that curve is like a red zone. And when you have a variety of factors, whether they're stress, alterations in mood, sometimes being neurodivergent, for example, autism spectrum, or having sensory overload, it's in that moment of acuity where the brain is basically starting to Google, how do I escape? And sometimes those escape thoughts are simply very concrete language about how to make pain stop.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, we'll, for example, like language is tricky too, say things like, if you don't knock that off, I'm going to kill you.
Right.
We don't mean it.
Right.
But it's a very concrete way of making a point. And that can also happen internally.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And the other challenge from my path, I mean, I don't know if this works with children, but from my path, because I'm a musician, so I had another tool. I think it's hubris to assume that we can articulate every feeling that we have.
Is it useful?
Right. Well, that's the other question. Yeah. But even in like processing it to yourself, like you can't think something you don't have a word for,
mm-hmm.
unless you use other vehicles, which is why I love arts and therapy so much. But you get to when you're at the top of your curve, and you're Googling, there aren't even words for what you're trying to describe or what you're trying to search for, and And that's a huge obstacle.
It is. And especially the way when you're at the top of that curve, language becomes almost like its own closed loop where you're stuck there.
That's
just
it.
Overthinking.
That's it. Yep.
And let me know if the following is true, because here's what I've observed. Like with your experience, this is what I've observed in my experience. Rather than having a big debate at the top of that curve about ideas, if you're able to bring the stress down below the red line, then the thoughts may stop all by themselves.
Yes, completely true.
And a mistake that happens is trying to work it out through thinking in that zone where you're just stuck in a tornado.
So true.
So let's make the tornado stop. Let's learn how to come down. And then can you see the difference?
Yep.
Now. And so back to your original question was, what advice would you give to parents?
Yes.
Rather than getting into that debate and that fight, when you notice your kids spinning, and it could be about a variety of things. It could be aggression. It could be suicidal thoughts. The list is very long, right, of behaviors that become concerning. What we're trying to do is get out of that red zone, bring the temperature down, and then be able to proceed. Another way that I will sometimes say it to parents is connect, then correct.
Mm. Well, yeah, I love that. Yeah. That's so to back up what you're saying with my own stupid story. So I got prescribed like a gazillion medications, and they all counterindicated, and I took lithium. If
some folks that are not treated well by lithium,
it's toxic to me.
Yep.
So it starts turning. So
and for others, it's a miracle.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
I'm not averse to medication at all. It just didn't work for me. So, but to your point of connect first and then correct. So what I did is. Well, I did it the wrong way. Listeners, if you've heard the story before, fast forward 45 seconds. I did a cold turkey. I was on like 7 and just went cold turkey. That's a mistake. Don't do that.
And I wondered if embedded in there was, you realized that this wasn't working for you. You didn't want to suffer this way anymore. And you chose to take a rather radical step that you believed that would move you to a better place. And I could imagine that in between of getting to the better place was pretty ornery and gnarly.
So I took my daughter into a house for a summer, and because when you're crazy and you tell people I'm going to get off the drugs for craziness, they say you're crazy, which is tacky. And then
not a useful word.
I don't know. That's an interesting.
It depends.
It's an interesting discussion because. I'll tell you this, because that's fascinating. Everybody bails, which I understand. I wouldn't want to be there for that train wreck either. So my daughter at the time is 7. So we hole up in a house and we do 2 months. But my plan was I was going to clean everything and then see if I was still suicidal. And if I was, then my daughter would be back in school and then I would be able to do it. So we get through the whole summer of throwing up and spending days in towels because it was horrible. I get to the end of it and I realize, like, well, look, she did all the work. Like, she would walk me around and she would make me a peanut butter sandwich and just really beautiful. So I get to the end of it and I'm like, no, that can't be the reward for this. So I was still suicidal, but I just, like, the injustice of it got to me that that can't be the reward for all the work that she just did. Because that'll ruin her for life. So I took up meditation, but like really, and one of the things that meditation teaches. So people think meditation, you sit and you don't think. No, you think all day long, but you learn how to manage your thoughts. And you when you have a thought, I can let it go. That's not necessarily true. That's not even me. I don't know what that thought is. And you learn to let thoughts go, and then you can manage. You can manage the situation, but only first, to your point, through connecting first, calming down, get out of the static, and then start making decisions. And so I do it every. I think my condition's chronic, so I do it every day and twice a day. And
that is such a powerful skill.
Oh, it's amazing,
right? Yeah. And so it's interesting working with the kids now. Mindfulness has become such a thing.
Yeah.
Right, to the point that it's almost like a meme that they'll joke about.
Right.
And as you describe it, it is a foundational life skill.
Yep.
Because it allows you to be present, know what's happening, and make effective choices. And something that you discovered in that process that not many folks realize is thinking is also a behavior.
Yes. I didn't think of wording it that way, but that's it precisely.
And in particular, thoughts arise involuntarily.
Yep.
They just pop up. And then we have a behavioral choice. What do we do with the thought? Where do we place our attention? And thoughts that receive our attention get stronger. Thoughts that don't receive our attention weaken.
I was in therapy for so long, and if a therapist had just sat me down on day one and said, okay, here's the rule. Just because you think it doesn't mean it is so. you think it, and then, like you just said, and now you have choices. If somebody had told me that I had choices about what I was thinking, I would have saved a gazillion dollars and gotten here quicker.
There's nothing cooler than to show up with somebody who's under age 10 and have that discussion, and the kid gets it.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And then, wow, what did they do with that tool?
Have a wonderful life.
Go forward.
Yeah, that's fantastic. The word crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Here's why I use it. Tell me if I'm wrong. And my job's different than yours. So my job is in part to just lifting stigma. And because a lot of people, you're not the first one. A lot of people take me to, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say is like contextually and with the vibe and what it conveys, it totally makes sense. In my world, particularly since I supervise other therapists,
mm-hmm.
I have a very tight line on it for the following reason. It's not specific enough about giving me details on behaviors or symptoms of concern. And it can also have an emotional tinge to it that takes you out of your blended science art mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I hear somebody saying that, like as a clinician, I'll bring them back and say, could you explain the specific behaviors and symptoms that have you use that word?
Right.
Now, if you're hanging out with your friends and you're having that discussion more socially or within a broader group, right? That's kind of a different context, but that's like my own condition.
That completely makes sense. I get called to task about it using the word when I tell my own story, but I use it for the following reason. Part of confronting mental health, child or no, part of confronting mental health is fear.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know eventually – my wife broke her ankle 6 weeks ago. I know eventually.
Ow.
Yeah. She was on an exercise bike, a spin class, and her knee caught the water bottle holder, and the pedal kept moving and broke her ankle. Now, I know that eventually I'm going to not have to do every single chore in the house, and she'll be back up and running, which is great. But with mental health, part of some disease there is the elimination of hope, and that's how you get suicidal, is the elimination of hope. And so and that's fear based.
Mm-hmm.
So when I use that word, my thinking is, if I can't say it, if it's so bad that I can't say it, then I'm giving it all the power, and I'm proving that I'm afraid of it. And like anything else, the more you say it, the less afraid of it you become. And also, again, our jobs are very different.
And it's a chance for you to reclaim power over that word.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I think, I've had, listeners of the show write me and talk about using the word crazy and say, I think I'm crazy, but I could just never say to another person, I'm crazy, because that word has, a stigma to it. So I'm like, no, just say it. And then do what you say. And then fill in the blanks and go, okay, well, what's crazy look like to you? And how do you... and what are we going to do about it?
And to validate your strategy there, right? Like what we know too in terms of behavioral science and how we operationalize that in therapy is, if there's something that's really triggering for you, over time exposing yourself to it and building
therapy,
a kind of immunity will give you that power, rather than you having automatic reactions that throw you off your
game. Right. And that strategy does work, because what used to keep me in the house 24/7 now is my career. so it works. Maybe just say the word crazy to friends and maybe you'll have a podcast.
And it's so vivid and experiential.
Yeah.
It's a description too. And right, as you described that moment that you had with your daughter in that window of time, that may be the best word to describe what that felt like.
Totally. I'm being taken care of by a 7-year-old girl because I can't do it myself, and everybody else bailed. And yeah.
What did she observe about that period of time?
It's so funny because I had her on. I interviewed her about it, and now you're gonna make me cry. And she said,
"Crying's okay.
Everybody cries in here. I'm surprised you haven't yet." So I said, like, because when it was all done, I got, and I'm very forward about it. I got a lot of heat that you shouldn't put a kid in that position, and you tell your daughter too much, and your daughter didn't need to see that people go to. People go places to have that experience. You don't do it in front of your kid. And she should have had another adult there as a balancing act and blah, 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 blah. And my wife checked in and out. She wasn't completely alone the whole time. But so I said to her, what was that for you? And why did you do it? Because that's an extraordinary choice for it. Because she picked it. She said, no, I'm staying with you. And she said, I knew that wasn't you. And nobody else was going to help. So I helped. And I was like, that's incredible that you knew that, and it wasn't me, but that she was able to see that was, it's still weird.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the truth of that too, right? Of her having the sense that I know who my dad is.
Yeah.
And almost as if I'm going to keep that light on.
Yep.
And hold the space until he can find it again.
And she, thank you, that's perfectly put. And she would actually call other adults in my life and say, "You got to get over here. He shouldn't be alone for this. He, you know, we need groceries. We need blah blah." She would advocate for me. And there's a picture. I wish I could find it. There's a picture of her. She's holding a. She's six and a half years old. She's chubby. She's holding a mug here, and on the mug it says. Everything she does sparkles, and she's got a phone in this hand, and she's talking to, I think, my sister about, like, hey, you know, how do I do the laundry? But help me work through this. It's just a really incredible, but saved my life, because, you know, you get to the end of that, and you're like, how do I let that down?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could imagine while that was happening or afterwards, you being concerned that was traumatic for her in some way. Or that might be, quote, scarring or difficult for her. How did that play out in terms of what the impact was?
I'll tell you how. And I don't know whether this is nature or nurture. But fast forward. So that ended and she's seven. So now fast forward 7 more years. My wife gets diagnosed with head and neck cancer. And it's horrible. She had a tumor 1.5 inches in her cheek. It spread to a lymph node. She had to have surgery. She went through this radical surgery and then this radical chemo radiation therapy after it. Just brutal, inhuman. How brutal. Her face was at, like, little ashes would come off her face. She was getting treated that bad. And my daughter, and it's part of my crazy strategy. My daughter, you know, I told her. So now she's 14, and I said, listen. Mom's got a cancer. This isn't going to be good. You can live somewhere else. You can go live with my sister for a while. This is going to be hard. This is all I'm going to be able to do for 1.5 years. And she said, no, I'm staying. She insisted on going to every doctor's appointment when we were getting test results. She's like, no, I'm going. The day after the surgery was, my wife had a bag on the side of her neck the size of a football full of blood and drainage, and her face was just so twisted off her head, and my daughter, we went to the hospital, and they're like, we don't let children see that. And my daughter fought it. She's just like, no, I'm going. And then they made me go home and write a letter, authorized, and she went up and did it. And so I asked her, what was that like? And she had the same answer. She said, I knew my mom was going to get better, and that's not my mom. And so I think she confronted something so scary in me that she learned how to handle scary things. And then I asked her, even Trish, my wife, said, like, you know, she shouldn't be here because the treatment was awful. I mean, you know, she's soiling herself. She's everything. And Trish is like, she shouldn't be here. And then one day after the treatment stops, that's not the end of the process. It's you're down for another 6 months. So my wife is crying, saying, you know, I've lost 2 years with her, And, you know, she hasn't had a mom for 2 years and she's crying. And so I went and talked to her about it. And I said, Graham, her name is Gramercy. I said, Gramercy, what do you think? Like, mom thinks that you lost 2 years. What's your takeaway? And she said, I didn't lose 2 years. I saw two people stick together.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was like, okay. I don't know whether showing her scary things makes that type of person, but.
It brings me full circle to an observation you had earlier, which was about children that are trapped in a situation.
Yeah.
Like, or an environment or a context and the stress of that when they don't have a choice. But what I hear with Graham is that it would have been more stressful for her if somebody told her she couldn't be there and she had to inhabit that space alone. And she made a choice to want to lean in and be with the people she loved in both of those scenarios because that's what she valued.
Wow. You are good, sir. Yeah. Yeah. That's fantastic. Right? That's fantastic.
And then from that standpoint, that what would have been traumatic for her perhaps is not being able to be there with both of you.
Right. Right.
Which would have been a very different scenario.
Yeah.
What she want to do when she as she moves on in her life?
Forensic psychology. I'm like, forensic psychology? Awesome. And she's like, yeah, she's going to school. Yeah, she's going to school for forensic psychology. So I'll give her your card when she gets out. Yeah. Maybe you can. Your personal path, how did you decide psychology?
So I'll give kind of the brief answer on that, which is I actually came to counseling a little later in life. When I was younger, I worked in communication. I wound up in tech and working with bigger companies that we know, like Microsoft and Motorola and Verizon, more like as a strategy consultant and research analyst. And then a point came where the light bulb went off that said, I'm not here to do this.
Mm.
Like very successful, quote unquote, and like just not having vitality and happiness about it anymore.
Mm.
And so that took me on a path where I explored that more, we could say, spiritually initially, really intense traditional Buddhist practice.
Yes.
And then going through that process, I asked myself, well, what do I do with this now? And decided that I would train as a counselor and help people that way and use those skills.
The decision to do good, fascinates me because one perspective on the decision to do good. So I'm fascinated by people who have successful corporate careers and then just go, that's 80% me, but it's not. And then choose to do good with it. Because it's almost, again, it's counterintuitive. Like the idea is rake in as much as you can for as long as you can, take care of your kids, and that's almost your job. That's almost your assignment. I get people walking away from corporate. I did it. I get people walking away from corporate. But then to decide, no, I'm going to walk away from corporate and go do good is what's the moral recipe for that?
I would say there's two things, right? I would never want to say that like staying corporate is a bad choice.
No.
Because we need good people in every role
and
every station in our society. For some people, they just wake up with a vitality and excitement about doing that.
Right.
And that's their groove.
Right.
And yay. And then I reached a point where I'm like, it's not my groove anymore.
How'd you get to Buddhism?
Let's see. I think my wife plugged me into that. She just was like getting interested in that and started studying and practicing and then really ran with it.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, I would say somebody who really inspired me early on in that path was the Dalai Lama. I was super curious, like, why was he not irate at China? Why is he not saying horrible, mean things? How does he maintain that loving stance? I'm curious. And wound up studying in that tradition for a period of time and then deciding what to do with it.
What's the biggest thing Buddhism taught you?
Compassion.
Mm. See, you're a better guy than me.
Well, I'll say that in the following way, right? One could mindfully rob a bank. You could be fully present.
Okay, yes. Okay, I see
moment,
what you're saying, right.
Noticing everything that's happening non-judgmentally and then do something that is not helpful to the world. So what sometimes is left out as the methods of the tradition are secularized is that compassionate and loving foundation. So there's a way that you can intentionally train to build that muscle.
Mm.
right?
Right.
In addition to your mindfulness skills that you talked about. And so on that basis, I thought about what are ways to be a benefit to others. And what I actually had done in the corporate world was a lot like counseling,
mm-hmm.
but it was more like around assessing what a department or a company's needs or a sales team or something like that,
right?
And so had those skills, had these other ones that I developed, and then also became a parent that put it front and center about like kids and families and the stressors and what do we do with this?
Right.
And the rest clicked into place.
When you... Family, we don't. Do we call it family therapy? Does that
we do? So, yeah, you can.
Oh, okay,
you can. So well, maybe it's useful for me to kind of give a little more detail about how our program runs, right? So the way that New York State defines home-based crisis intervention as a program, we typically will be in the home about 4 to 6 weeks, but we can go longer than that. We aim to do a minimum of 2 in-home sessions a week, and we can do more than that if it's useful and necessary. But we get a lot of flexibility around how we use that time. We could do individual therapy with the child. We could do family therapy, which is working on their relationships and their patterns. And we can do parent-only coaching, too, to be able to really spend time with them, allow them to unpack their story and build their skills about how they can be there for their kid. We have some situations where everybody in the family is excited and wants to participate. We have some where the child's like, I'm not in. And the parents are. And we can pivot and help them be more effective and restructure the environment. So those problems begin to change because they've learned to change the responses. And sometimes there are those rare cases where the parent's not super committed. And if that's the case, to be able to meet the child where they're at and like, this is a hard situation. How do we help you navigate this and give you some skills until you can get to the other side? 18's not that far.
Right. 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 That's the coping mechanism thing. Because that's kind of what I had to go to Astor. They didn't kind of meet. I don't even think they did that back then. Maybe they did. But that was kind of where we left it when I stopped was, look, you're just going to have to survive this. And then go, and like you said, 18's not that far. And on my 18th birthday, I got on a bus to Iowa. And I did. And I'm like, adios. 18's not far, but Iowa is. That's where I'm headed. So I bailed. But it must be difficult in when you have the whole family together to have to shift gears from – Or maybe it's not. Do you talk to children differently than you talk to adults?
It depends.
On?
Like on the child's interests, temperament, personality, intelligence. Sometimes having an adult-style conversation with them is super validating because they feel like the smartest one in the house.
Right. Right. Sometimes they are.
Other times, like as a baseline, I'd say what's fair is you want to meet everyone where they're at developmentally, right? And what works for them in terms of language, content, and be able to shift into what can click and connect. You don't want to talk over somebody. You don't want to talk under somebody.
Right.
So being able to kind of read the room and shift gears is a part of what you learn when you do the work.
A lot of what you do is behavioral.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always had this theory that behavioral has to be preceded by cognitive.
Mm.
And like I know for myself, like thinking before I do something is probably good.
It's so interesting. You just like zeroed in on a really powerful intersection point in the field and somehow that divides practitioners. Like in the following way, so you're probably familiar with like one of the dominant modes of treatment is what's called cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT, right? And an interesting, so that took two different streams. One was cognitive therapy, one was behavior therapy, and they wind up getting mashed and molded into something cohesive, but their origins are very different and have different assumption sets. So the origin of cognitive therapy was for somebody with, and if you consider anxiety or depression, for example, there might be very predictable kinds of thought patterns that come up with that they can identify and then work on changing those patterns as a way to help them get control over the mood that's actually driving the thinking.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
That makes sense, yep.
Okay. Then from a behavioral perspective, we would say, well, thinking is actually just another behavior. And I don't want to spend so much time like identifying, quote, thinking mistakes. Like I'll call them out, but only as it relates to, is it affecting my ability to be effective in what I want to do? Does
right.
that make sense?
Yep, that does, yep.
Okay. So from that perspective, like as we were talking about before, about like those choices in thinking – like, so rather than necessarily overanalyzing every thought about whether it's valid or invalid, just to notice that thinking's happening
mm-hmm.
and that you have a choice. And there's very practical implications to this. Like, consider anxiety, right? Let's say somebody is afraid of going through that door that's here in the studio. And they had these really intrusive thoughts about, I can't go through the door. The door's scary. What's on this? Like, you could spend a lot of bandwidth debating about whether those thoughts are valid. And if you simply learn to ignore the thought and grab the handle, you go through the friggin' door.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So you don't have to change a thought to do a behavior.
Right. That's discipline.
Right? So if there's an assumption that you have to change your thinking first, the behavior may never happen. Instead, you may lean into how do I do the behavior and manage the thoughts that come up while I'm doing the behavior.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah, yeah. And again, it's an art form because I imagine some cases I want to manage the thought and some cases I want to manage the behavior and it's – I could never do what you do.
But the key thing too is – and I hear this in your own life – is that's all in a frame of reference around what do I value,
right.
what's important to me, and am I able to move forward and lean into that and do it.
Right.
And where I tend to start feeling stuck and hopeless is when I'm ineffective or unclear about what I care about or ineffective in being able to do what I care about.
Right.
And in that standpoint, like a good therapist can just as much be a coach to help you work through those obstacles so you can just be your best self.
Right.
And I say that because there can be a lot of ideas for folks that haven't worked with a therapist or a counselor. Right, of I have to talk about my feelings. I have to. Da, da. No, you could actually show up to them like you would to a strength coach at the gym and say, I've got these three or four things that are really bugging me. Like, I feel like I'm stuck in my job. I'm starting to get really depressed and break down, like, well, do you not have the skills to be able to advocate for a raise? Are you not like able to assess what your strengths and your weaknesses are to find the right environment? Do you get stuck in some kind of self-defeating thought patterns that we can help unwind? So you can be very solution-focused about what you need and show up with an agenda. In fact, a therapist would love that. Here's the four things I want to work on today.
Yeah. 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 No, I imagine a therapist would love that. Because part of the – well, not – your job, you have 6 weeks, and then you can – but it's – you know, there's already kind of an assumed, this is when we start, this is what the middle is going to look like, and this is what the end is. But having been to a bunch of private practice mm-hmm. therapists, that's not always the case. And they're incentivized. And so I have been to some therapists who wouldn't like my goals because once I get them, then we're done, and they don't like that.
Yeah, but I tend to view it constructively as I'm trying to work myself out of a job.
Right.
And ideally, like, someday the war's over, nobody needs me anymore.
Right. I don't think that's going to happen, though.
Wouldn't it be wonderful?
It would be great, yeah.
But to your point, too, so for us, although we have that short window of time, what that means is because what brings a client to treatment for us is that level of acuity where they're facing inpatient hospitalization, identifying those one or two behaviors that are most dangerous or the patterns that contribute to them and focusing on that one thing mm-hmm. that gets you out of the danger zone. And then based on what we learned during that experience of time to really set you up for the next phase of work. So if you have an existing outpatient therapist, we'll collaborate with them and we'll let them know, hey, here's what we learned during this intense period of time. And we actually saw in the house multiple times a week. And, you know, not betraying a client's trust or privacy, but you get a different visibility than when somebody comes into your office for 40 minutes once every week or two.
Yep.
Right. You can see what the family fight looks like.
Right. Right. And where it's happening and
where
the vibe
it's happening and the whole vibe around it. Right.
Yeah.
And so like, even though we're done at 6 weeks, part of what we're tasked with doing is having a support network set up for them when we transition and discharge out, so that that's actually in place and ready to take the baton on for the next step.
Do you ever get to reconnect?
Yes.
I would imagine, because if not, that would be so heartbreaking.
It's quite a beautiful thing
to
have a parent or a child just reach out years later and say, you wouldn't believe it. I'm in college now. I'm doing well. It's great, right? And it didn't seem possible to them at that time.
Right.
But much like Graham did for you, if you've done this long enough and you can show up and you have confidence through your experience that things can get better and you can hold that for somebody, they begin to pivot themselves and their hopefulness begins to increase because they can see that you see it's possible for them. They can feel that in the room.
So my wife, she had the cancer, right? And this adds on to what you're saying. She said, like, this really hurts. We're going to go to the dentist. And she's very close with her dentist. So she goes to the dentist. 45 minutes later, she's in surgery. And for a biopsy, the surgeon comes out. He goes, I can take a little piece and send it to a lab, but I know what I'm looking at. Tell me to go deep. So they go deep, and then she starts this whole thing. And her dentist isn't part of the process, but we signed the form, so he's watching the whole thing. And it talks about the lasting impact of what you do. So she goes back. I'll never forget this. She goes back and she sees him when it's all done. And he comes in and she's crying and he's crying. They're hugging. And I'm just lucky to be in the room. And he goes, while they're hugging, he goes, how was it? And she's crying. And she goes, it was really hard. And he goes, now you know you can do hard things. And the rehab after that was because she had a win and somebody highlighted it for her. And I love that people can reconnect with you and say, hey, I had a win then and it gave me the ability to win now.
It's so powerful what you just described with the doctor, and it's something that our team does really well on coaching parents to notice very small behavioral changes that are moving in the direction that they want to have as the ultimate outcome, right? So let's say a kiddo is having just like total meltdowns, tantrums to the point that maybe they're punching a hole in the wall or maybe they're hurting their sibling. And that's happening 8 times a week on average. And then after we've worked with them for 14 days, it's now happening 5 times a week. Now, from the parent's perspective, anything but zero feels intolerable.
Right, right.
Right.
But that's actually a big win, though.
Correct.
Right.
And to be able to really coach, and do you see the progress we've made? Mm. We've gone from 8 to 5. I predict within 2 more weeks, we'll be down to 3.
Mm.
And if you stick with me for another 2 more weeks, we may get down to 1. And if you stick with us over the longer period of time, you may actually get to 0. But it's so hard, right? Like, as you observe yourself and your experience about how the mind works under stress.
Mm-hmm.
So that hopelessness, because it becomes very ruminative, like it's never going to get better. It sucks. They're all blah, 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 blah,
right.
blah. Like, if you can step out of it and ground and start look at the facts, you can make more effective choices. But if you're spinning
right.
that way and you see that behavior come back from your child, it's very hard to meet it in a way that is rational
right.
and kind.
I love, too, that you consider a 19-year-old a child. Because they are,
yeah.
But I that's counterculture.
It's so interesting. It's a new development from the Office of Mental Health. So historically, we were 5 to 18. And just about 18 months ago, they increased our age range to 20 and 11 months. With the specific provision that the youth is residing in a family system.
Right.
Right. So not like somebody who's off of college, but somebody who's having trouble launching and adulting. And the part of that that really makes sense to me is you don't automatically want to throw an 18-year-old or an 18-and-a-half-year-old into the adult mental health system just because they had a birthday.
Right. Exactly right. Yeah. No, that makes complete sense.
Right.
Substance abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Do you the treatment window for substance abuse, I would imagine, is longer than – it's lifetime actually, right?
Mm-hmm.
What percentage of your work is that?
It's interesting. Something I'll step back and say is I appreciate at an agency level something Aster does well is they've worked hard to stretch their capacity to work with dual diagnosis and co-occurring mental health and substance use. We actually have a psychiatrist who that's their specialty.
Oh, wow.
That understands both substance use and its impact on psychiatric medications. So if somebody is having a substance use disorder, they can navigate that harm reduction strategy instead of just panicking about you can't be on meds at all. They can build that relationship and say, okay, let's be transparent about how you're using, what are you using, how do we keep you safe, and move you onto a path where you might not need that anymore.
Right.
She's phenomenal. She actually within the agency facilitates a process if as any clinician, if we have a kid who is struggling with substance use and we're concerned about we might not know the mechanics of this, like in terms of the chemical compounds or what that means in terms of solutions, we can actually call a consultation team that she leads. She'll spend an hour with us along with six other people and talk about what's happening with this particular human. What's the pharmacology? What are the substances doing? How that may affect their behavior and come out of that meeting with a plan and actually have like an expert on staff that helps us with that. It's so helpful.
You guys are angels, man. That's amazing. And I love what you said. And I had never thought about it. So you just said it just now. Because I imagine most substance abuse plans are discipline based, and the idea is today you're not going to do X, and tomorrow you're not going to do X. I love your strategy so much better. Of I'm going to get you to a place where you don't need to do that anymore. That to me seems like an actual solution.
Well, especially to
instead of willpower.
Yeah, and the willpower, it's not like it's invalid, and it doesn't seem to fully hit the mark in the following way, because it tells you that if you didn't rock it and have complete sobriety today, you failed.
Right.
And how does that affect your motivation?
Right. Right. It reinforces the fact that you can't win.
Correct.
Yeah.
And as you indicate there too, right, if part of the issue is the substance use is about a way to manage other symptoms, you know, if you are smoking a lot of weed because you have PTSD, or because it helps you with your anxiety, for me to show up and say you must stop, they'll just look at me and say, well, you're an idiot. This is the one thing that makes me feel better.
That was always my rant about Dr. Phil. I could never stand Dr. Phil because every 3 out of 5 days a week, he'd have somebody who's overweight on the show, and he or she would say, I'm overweight, and he'd say, you need to eat less. And I'm like, well, oh, wow, there
gee,
it is.
I hadn't thought of that.
Right, thank you. That's why you're the doctor. Thank you. Problem solved.
So what can be really effective, right, is if you can build a relationship with someone to the point where they can begin to look and notice, is it fully working for you in the way that you think it is, or are there perhaps some side effects that are impacting your life in a way that you're not accounting for? And how do we substitute some alternative behaviors that get you what you want in being effective but don't have those negative side effects?
That's, do you I'm bouncing off of what you just said, what degree does exercise play in your...
It is, you know what's cool? I don't know if you've seen any of the data that's come out of the last year or two very much around exercise and depression,
yep,
for example, right?
Yep.
So, like we were talking before about like kind of being in that red zone and initiating a change in your body that then will change your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than using the mind to change the mind, you're using the body to bring the mind down,
yep,
right? So the same thing can happen with your mood. So we know that like endorphins, all that are released when you exercise, like very positive.
Right.
I also would assume too that there's a strong behavioral component in the following way. Any of us even that really enjoy exercise, there's some of those days where you're just having a butt dragging morning.
Yep.
And you're just saying, should I go to the gym? Should I go for my hike? And like having a process where you learn to work through that and take effective action,
yep,
is some of the best medicine you can have. And exercise is one of those things that can help you do that and build a healthy routine. So yes, there's all the physiological benefits that come from exercising, but doing that particular behavioral process,
yep,
is so powerful.
Yep. I use exercise daily to manage. And I, like yesterday, I was having just a hard, just all kinds of anxiety all day, yesterday morning. I'm like, I'm just going to go work out until I'm too tired to be nervous anymore. And it worked. I worked out pretty hard. And by the time I was done, I'm like, all right, I'm too tired to even care about this anymore. Let's go home and go back to work.
And it's a genius strategy, right?
Yeah.
Like, so one could say, you should really pick up the phone and call your therapist. Well, on the other side is, if I've known myself and I observed that doing the following things improve my mood and have me feel better, why don't I just do that?
Right.
So there's like one particular, particularly when we're working with suicidal individuals or those that are self-harming, a evidence-based treatment that's really powerful is called dialectical behavior therapy, or DBT. And DBT offers a menu of skills that you can use to be able to improve your behaviors and build what's called a life worth living. And so what DBT says, instead of being a suicide prevention program, we're a life worth living program. We're going to help you realize what you value and how do you develop skills to move toward them. So one of the skills for somebody who is in a moment of acute distress is called TIP. And there's three parts of it. There's a fourth P, but I'm going to focus on the first three. So T is temperature, I is intense exercise, P is paced breathing. So different people's bodies respond to different stimuli differently. The temperature one is really interesting. There's something that's called the mammalian dive reflex. Do you know about this?
No.
So like you might hear a story of somebody like is ice fishing and they fall into the water and it's almost like they wind up in a kind of a suspended animation because their body starts to shut down that allows them to stay alive longer. It's the same thing with like aquatic mammals, right? But what's happening is the cold temperature is down-regulating the body to support survival. So for somebody who's like at the top of that curve where they're completely amped up, like we could be talking about things you could do, but actually what they discovered in DBT is you could put your face in ice water and count to 20. And your body starts to trigger that response where it brings you down.
Oh, that's cool.
And some folks will do that with ice packs, like because it is most powerful like around the nose and under the eyes. And it's a physiological response. It's not like a talking strategy. Like you're
doing something
with your body
right,
to bring your emotions and your thinking back into balance.
And it helps with bagginess too.
Yeah, that too. And like so similar, like
that's
you
so cool.
Like you identify the next one is like intense exercise.
Right.
Right? Like I know that if I'm just feeling like agitated and amped up, I go work out, I'll feel better in an hour.
Yep.
And the mistake for me would not to do the thing that I know that works.
Right.
Right. And then the P is like paced breathing. Some people, they may do better with like deep breathing, relaxing. But again, there's all these body-based strategies, not just thinking strategies.
Mm. Wait, do you imagine, well, that dialectical
behavior therapy.
Thank you. DBT almost sounds a lot like the approach for substance abuse. Like I'm just going to move you to a place where you don't need whatever behavior you don't want.
Yeah, the person who developed that, Dr. Marsha Linehan, is an extraordinary individual. As a teenager, she unexpectedly had a meltdown that led her to a long-term inpatient psychiatric hospitalization, was struggling with suicidality, with self-harming, couldn't keep herself safe, and in a very spiritual sense, made a vow that I'm going to get out of here somehow and help anybody else who's stuck here. And wound up going back to school, putting herself through school, through grad school, and putting on a behavioral science lens of how do we actually understand what's happening, why it's happening, and teach skills so people can navigate and get themselves out of hell.
Right. Beautiful.
And she operationalized that through like super rigorous research over a long period of time. And along the way, part of her journey was she wound up practicing Zen. And she then was one of the first people to actually convert Zen mindfulness into behavioral science so you could teach it. And there's a real practical reason for that, right? Like if somebody is feeling so agitated, overwhelmed, having intrusive trauma thoughts, if you just say sit with your breath, that'd be excruciating.
Yeah, it was for the longest time. No, you're right.
And so what she did was break that down into smaller micro skills so you could teach the skill without having to sit with what you can't handle yet to be able to build up the capacity so someday you can.
Right.
But much like you observed earlier too, right? Like in those moments, even with Graham, being able to notice and choose.
Right. Right. Buddhism. Observe.
Yeah. Observe. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, and it's so interesting. Like Buddhism, I think it's even not super helpful to call it a religion.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I don't think it's a religion.
And the Dalai Lama calls it a science of mind. Yep. In some ways, I think it was like the original CBT.
Yeah, yeah. And do you meditate?
Oh, yeah.
So you know meditation. Listener, meditation is a physical practice too. Mm-hmm. Sitting, you go much past like 15, 20 minutes, your body starts talking to you as well. So people, like I said, there's so many misconceptions about meditation that drive me nuts, and one of them is like it's all mental. No, right? A good percentage of it is physical. I love what you do. What's the next step forward in your field that we don't know about yet?
Yeah, I'm gonna say one thing before I get there.
Yeah.
Which is like a step forward that's super exciting for us in the program that we're working with right now. So Aster has offered HBCI for more than 30 years.
Oh, wow.
First in Dutchess County and then in Ulster County.
Is tapping that too? Is that?
That is a modality that can be used. Like sometimes it's used as part of EMDR.
Okay.
I'll come back to that.
Okay, sorry. I interrupted you.
No, it's okay. So the program we're describing, like of doing the home visits, working with the family in the home. So we've done this for a long time here and we've been very effective with it. And New York State noticed that a lot of places in the state didn't have it. And so just over the last 18 months, the state made a commitment to work to make it available in every county of the state. And so what they did was suggest to existing providers to do this well, hey, maybe you could think about doing more of it. Mm. And so we're just like so grateful they gave us in 2023 one round of funding that allowed us to increase our team in Dutchess and Ulster. Then they came back and did a second round, and now we are expanding and are just starting service in four other counties.
Congratulations.
We're going north into Columbia County, into Greene County in the south, into Putnam and Westchester. And they've never had this particular service in those counties.
That's incredible.
And so like when I look at like kind of evolution, for me, something is just super exciting is helping more families get access to what we already know works now.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also all kinds of future cool things that are coming too.
Congratulations.
Right? Yeah. And I'll say this too, right? Sometimes, particularly in the current political environment, there can be just this like negativity around government and blah, blah, blah. And like, I will say when you go buy something or when you pay your tax bill, thank you. You're funding us. You're keeping kids alive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
No, that's government actually working. Yeah.
And so, bless them for seeing the value of the program, for being able to invest what citizens invest when we pay all the time to do good.
Yeah. I was just glad you ended on the word good. Do you think that's the nature of good? That it's also the nature of bad, but I tend to think that we think of good as just an isolated thing that won't expand on its own, whereas we think of bad as ever-growing.
Sometimes it feels like good is working against the bad of gravity.
Yeah.
I met a guy once who was he was a former NASA engineer, and so his operative phrase was, well, with enough thrust, anything can fly.
That happens to be true. So
gravity can feel heavy.
Yeah.
Right? Like, quote, bad can feel overwhelming, and we just need a little more thrust.
That's the story. Because I'm going to try to pitch you having Aster be part of the Lifted Project. That's the story behind the Lifted Project, is flying and thrust. It's so funny you said that. So my wife gets done with the cancer treatment, but can't walk, can't turn her head, can barely eat, speech is hard. The back of her head is bald from radiation treatment, doesn't want to go out, doesn't want to be seen. Her face is literally black with ash every day. When you're done with that kind of treatment, the advice is go home. And that's it. So one nurse said, you can do physical therapy. And like my wife's like, the last thing I want to do is go back to a hospital. So I started, so like she wasn't even walking. And so I went, it was a day in January, clear blue sky. And I'm like, we got to try to walk. Let's just go see if we can get to the mail. And I put on her winter coat. That's too heavy for her. Like, she can't stand up with it on. So I take a blanket. And all right, let's just go outside. And so I walk her outside. And I see her turning her head. And usually that means there's something wrong with her neck. But she's turning her head like this. And I saw the sun hitting her face. And I actually, like, physically saw her remembering the sun because she hadn't seen it in so long. So day by day, we do 10 feet. We do 20 feet. We do 20 feet 3 days and then 25 feet. Finally, I get her to like where she can walk to the end of the driveway and back, but it doesn't get much past that. So I'm like, okay, this is going to work. So I have a trainer, talking about exercise. I have a trainer who's a friend, and she teaches these exercise classes. And, you know, and so I said, hey, can I bring Trish to class? We'll sit in the back. And she can't do anything, but she can at least shuffle. And so my friend says, yeah, of course, bring her. So I bring her in. And she's got a sweatshirt on and a hat and glasses and a big scarf. That's when everybody said, we go to the back of the room. And music starts and teacher starts. And Trish is like shuffling her feet a little bit. And I'm like, okay, that's something. My friend sees this and says, no, we can't have that. Goes to the back, pulls her to the front, and starts shuffling with her. And tells everybody else in the class what to do while she's shuffling with Trish. One of the most beautiful things I ever see. We get in the car, and Trish goes, do you think I could come back? And at the same time, the phone's ringing, and it's my friend saying, you got to bring her back. So we worked together every day for a whole summer. One of the things was that we do, you know what box jumps are?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So she had neuropathy, and my wife, and her head wouldn't talk to her feet. So walking was tricky, running was out of the question, and box jumping was insane. So one day, everybody's box jumping, and my friend brings out a platform. It's like 3 inches, and is like, try this. And so she tries, and she falls, and she's crying. And my friend leans down, and they go forehead to forehead, and they talk for like 2 minutes. And I don't know what was said, but Trish wipes her nose, gets back up, and just starts lifting weights again. End of that class, they walk over to a 2-foot box jump. And my friend says, we're not stopping until you're on that box. And we're like, you're insane. Like, at that point, we were wondering, like, maybe jogging would be, like, the ultimate. Worked on it every single day. For 3 months, every single day. Worked on, can I step up on it? Can I step up on 3 inches? Can I step up on 6 inches? And they have this, and they developed this beautiful relationship of just love and trust. And little by little, Trish starts doing things that she couldn't do before. So one day, Trish walks over, and this is – I don't know what type of therapy this is. You'll be able to tell me. But Trish walks over to the 2-foot box, and she's to the point now where she can lift her feet and just put a foot on it and then put another foot on it. My friend walks over, and they go forehead to forehead again. But this time I can hear because I'm standing right there. And my friend goes, you can do this today. You are a feather. You can fly. You can do this today. Steps back. There's a whole circle of class gathers around Trish, and she's sitting there. And it's like, up till now, she hasn't even stepped up on the box. But because of the trust, and she looks at me, she looks at my friend, and she lifts up onto the box. It was insane. People cried for 20 minutes. It was one of the most beautiful things they ever saw because it was all based on belief in self, trust in somebody else, and small wins along the way to get you up there. And so what kind of therapy is that?
I would call that profound common sense. and love.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And connection,
mm-hmm.
and community. And
yeah.
Something that's important for us over in therapy land to remember too, right, that sometimes the best medicine may be way more than therapy. It may be your social connections, your extended family, your religious faith, your work,
yeah,
right? And how do we help you strengthen and build those networks that give you that meaning and purpose and that feedback loop of being successful rather than just viewing you as somebody who's ill and needs to be fixed?
Right.
Right. And as you've like indicated in those situations, right, when you start to taste, I can do this through direct experience in the quote real world.
Oh, yeah.
That's where you start feeling more powerful and effective.
Yep. Yep.
And so it's interesting, too. This like recognition of that has become more prevalent in the mental health field.
Interesting.
Particularly within services for children and families, where there's a lot of emphasis now on how do we assess what a child and family's whole network of strengths are and their values? How do we help build that up? And how do we connect them with other supports that might not be therapy? Mm. It might be a mentor. It might be like a group or interest that they have in their community. It could be going to the Boys or Girls Club. It could be taking martial arts. It could be getting connected with a club at school or getting to know their guidance counselor better. And like, let's not just like think individual person, individual problem, but like, what's their life?
That's beautiful.
And how do you help their life become better? So like when I think of Aster too, there's many different programs that kind of work in that way that help get out of the therapy box and begin to do peer support, what sometimes is called care coordination, like linking to other resources in the communities a youth or family might not know about.
Right.
And how do you build like that rich tapestry that becomes a valued life?
What else does Aster do?
Whew, the list is long. Something I'll point to like within our own department. So HBCI, Home-Based Crisis Intervention, is within the Crisis Services Department of Aster. Another program we have is a program called Partial Hospitalization. There's one in Poughkeepsie. There's one down in Nyack in Rockland County. And back to your original question, what should a parent do around suicidality?
Right.
Right. Key things I would say is, you know, listen, be present with your kids. If you're beginning to hear anything along those lines, get assessed, right? And connect your kid with treatment by somebody that understands that particular problem.
Mm.
So partial hospitalization does very similar to what we do, but they do it as a structured day program that you would go there instead of school, you would learn and practice skills, you would have family sessions, and you would take that with you to march on in the world. But they're also working at that level of care that allows that intense teaching to happen without having to go inpatient and be in a hospital. You can take what you learn during the day at the partial program and bring it home at night.
Right.
And practice it where the problem's happening.
Right.
It also includes psychiatry if somebody needs an evaluation or medication adjustment recommendations. So those are two programs, like when we think about this epidemic around risk of safety with suicidality, that are super helpful. For since with a podcast, right, you're gonna have folks listening all over the world.
Yep.
Dial into those resources where you live. They're not always obvious. And what's so hard as a parent, when you're in crisis, now I'm supposed to know where all my resources are?
Right, 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 right.
So, and Dutchess, a phenomenal resource is the Stabilization Center on North Road in Poughkeepsie. It's essentially like mental health urgent care 24/7. You don't have to go to the ER. You can walk in if you are having a mental health issue, a substance use issue, having suicidality. A licensed clinician will assess you in that moment and connect you with other services. If you need to go to the hospital, they can facilitate that. If you can be connected with community services, they'll facilitate that. But you don't have to have the whole hospital experience to like get connected with treatment.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
And other counties have versions of that too.
Wow. Wow. I didn't even know that existed.
Yeah, it's like right kind of down by Marist.
Oh, okay.
Off Route 9.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
You personally going to be doing this for another 20 years?
I have a hard time imagining not doing what I love.
That's beautiful. Yeah, yeah. But best career advice I ever got was pick a career where you can always get better at it no matter how old you are. And I thought, oh, podcasting would work for me, but for you, obviously, yeah, that's fantastic. Again, how do we donate? Did I miss anything?
I'll flip it around. Did I miss anything?
Well, I could sit for another hour and a half, but you need to go save the world.
What I would say too is that, so as it pertains to Aster, to be able to donate and support the organization, you can link with that through the Aster website. You can also, through the AsterServices.org website, see the full menu of services that we offer in the Hudson Valley and also in the Bronx, and get a sense of how to connect with those different providers. So if you, for example, navigate through Aster programs, you'll see a whole menu of them. One of include mine, Home-Based Crisis Intervention. My phone number's on there and my email. So if this sounds like to you something your family needs, then we can talk about that. Something that I love about our program, too, is the way New York State has set it up. You can actually refer as a parent. You don't have to have a doctor make a referral or an addition clinician referral. We have some kids where this is their first contact with the mental health system.
Right.
Like they thought their son or daughter was fine, and then all of a sudden a crisis is happening, and now they need to find a way to get onboarded. And to do that in a way where the first question isn't what's your insurance,
right?
But instead what's happening, right. And how do we make it better,
right?
Is really a blessing.
That's fantastic. Astor website is?
AstorServices.org.
Beautiful. I'll make sure I have a link there. You did a good psychologist move there. You flipped it back around on me. That was well done. You are very well trained. Did I miss anything?
I just I so appreciate your lived experience.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
Right? And how you hold a space to have these really meaningful discussions.
Oh, thank you.
Based on what you've lived. And it reminds me too, you know, going back with your daughter, there's a lot of talk about PTSD.
Yeah.
But what's not often talked about is the other body of research around, so PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder. There's another body of research around something called post-traumatic growth.
Mm.
And people that have something really hard that happens, and somehow they manage to get stronger through that.
Yep.
And scientists started to get really curious about what are the mechanisms by which growth can happen rather than having a traumatic disorder. And as I hear your family's story, I see so much post-traumatic growth.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Thank
and
you.
How your daughter wants to carry that forward.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
Yeah, we got lucky. Yeah, we definitely. That's definitely not nature. Thank you so much for everything you're doing, man. And please.
I'm grateful to do that. And I want to emphasize, too, so I'm here like as a representative of the agency and of the program that I have the privilege to lead. There's 18 of us. We have an amazing team. Each of them, each therapist has their own strengths. Each supervisor has their own strengths. And what I love is we found a way to operate a program that has like a positive family culture ourselves.
That's great.
Because it would seem kind of strange to go into a home and coach on family therapy if you can't have a good work family.
Yeah.
How would that work?
Yeah. And it's so funny because like you think about like I kind of want to name a particular agency, but there are some government agencies where that do what you do on a different level, but that intervene in home, and the work done around building a team to do that, they probably don't have the budget or time for it, but that's not emphasized. And I've always thought what you just said, like if I'm coming out of a place where I can't do this, how am I going to spread that?
And for folks that wind up in those kinds of situations, don't assume that you don't have any power to make it better.
Right.
If it's not true to your values.
Right.
And if you use the skills that you have, that you've learned and you trade in, why not use it to make it better?
Yeah. Well said, sir. Do you guys sit around and analyze each other? That's a meeting I would so die in if I walked into your team and you guys were.
Something I would say about our team too that I love is the discipline of maintaining a non-judgmental stance and a stance of compassion and curiosity when talking about the clients and families we work with.
Yeah.
Because it's very easy as you get stressed out to go negative.
Right.
Right. And just whine.
Yeah.
And not helpful, right? Something that I didn't mention with our work is our clinicians will do like multiple sessions at home a week. They're also directly on call for their families 9 to 5 during the normal workday.
Oh, wow.
In case something blows up. And we have a team member that takes a rotation in sequence for the after hours. So somebody on our team is always available 24/7.
Wow.
If somebody is really struggling or moving into danger. So they can call us, and because we work as a team and we share about what's happening in our cases in a positive way, they're not calling a stranger.
Right.
Like, oh my gosh, I heard that you were struggling with this and you've been working on this skill and it's not working for you right now. What can we try?
Right.
How do we keep you safe? And be able to map that out together as a group. That teamwork is really important to be able to do something like that.
That's fantastic. Man, I love that you do what you do. I love that there's an agency that you can do it in, and I love that there's a state that supports that. That's kind of a perfect storm.
It positively amazes me that like all of that lines up,
right?
And it's able to happen because, as you say, there's some like I view that situation as precious.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then likewise too, think about us being invited into somebody's home, and like how sacred that is.
Yeah.
Like I'm sitting around your dining room table.
Right.
Talking about how can we help your kid live.
I love that you respect that.
How can you not?
I bet you.
And I know it happens that it's not that way, right? But when you feel it and when you have that experience with the family, it is so powerful and so special. And to think that they trust us enough in their most vulnerable moment to let us in.
Yeah.
Like, wow.
Yeah. And if we are in crisis, the best way to get a hold of you is the website?
Yeah, it can be. And okay. Also, if there's an immediate crisis where there is that sense of worrying about hospitalization, life-threatening, there's always 988.
Right.
Right, which is the National Suicide Hotline. That actually goes to a team. So a thing you know about 988 is it's automatically routed by your area code on your phone.
Oh, wow. So I didn't know that.
Yeah, so if you have like a mobile phone and you just moved up from Westchester and 914, it's going to route your call down there.
Right.
If you have an 845, if you were up in Dutchess, for example, it's going to route your call locally.
I'm coming back to Dutchess, so I'll change my...
Well, and so the thing to know about that, right, so here in Dutchess, that call would get routed down to a team that's called Helpline. That also is co-located close to the stabilization center, right? So do they need to send somebody out to the home to help somebody? Do they need to help them get to immediate help? So knowing that those immediate crisis resources are available, like Helpline, like stabilization center, can be your immediate response. Just how do I deal with this now? And one can always go to the ER if they have to.
Right.
Right? And a goal can also be that becomes a pathway to services, rather than like an endpoint.
Right.
But like there can be that moment where it feels like, oh, fire drill, fire's happening, what do I do?
Right.
So like, yes, emergency response there, and how can I connect with the appropriate level of care to solve the problem in a sustainable way?
Beautiful. Thank you so much, man.
Oh, you're welcome. I appreciate you inviting me to come.
Please, and come back, please.
Sure.
Because I got through like half the questions. But I know you have like a rest of the day, but I'm serious, please come back.
Yeah.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you so much. All right, I'm done. That was home from here.